do it. And a lot of people did it, and responsible for the first meeting, along with Herbert Locklear, about the injustice of the sheriff department. I was in the first meeting of that. But anyway,
okay.
I'll let you just ask.
I'll just try to ask some questions, and if it's free-flowing, that's all right.
Okay.
You know, because the point of this is for y'all to direct the conversation and tell the story that you feel like you want to tell. Now, what probably we're most interested in, I guess, is the things that both of you feel like you directly observed or participated in. Because that's what oral history gives us that documents can't give us. You know, documents can give you hearsay, documents can give you perceptions or opinions, but not that direct experience. And that's, oral history is all about that direct experience. So maybe since we've talked some about Tuscarora history, local history, North Carolina, you know, here in Robeson County, maybe we could talk about the two of you, your Tuscarora ancestry, and how that goes back, and how that's influenced your actions, the stances that you took during the Civil Rights Movement.
Before I talk directly about my ancestors, I think I want to go back and talk about one of our brave white ladies, Miss Mary Norma. She mentioned in a slurring way, in a derogatory way, I think, in her sense, she mentioned Henry Barry Lowry's father Allen's mother, William Lowry's wife, I believe her name was Betsy, as being the daughter of Bennett Locklear. Bennett was called Tuscarora Indian by Mary Norman. And to those folks, I guess being called a Tuscarora was kind of, you know, like a put down. And yet she didn't know that she was really, you know, giving vital information that would help in genealogy, in the backtracking. And Bennett was a Revolutionary War soldier along with John Brooks. They were both in the same battalion in the Revolution. And Bennett had already moved to this area and set up residence, fairly well entrenched in the community. And when they, you know, those people were semi-literate when they wrote their names down. Bennett gave his name as Lockelier, typical prospect, Long Swamp. And so I knew immediately, just reading his name on the Revolutionary War rolls, where did he actually live, because of the way he sounded his name, for the man to spell it out. So he was Tuscarora, had already moved in here with the earlier migrations, had settled down and had established himself before he went into the war of the Revolution. And so Bennett is a direct link to Tuscarora in Bertie County for the people here, because he was actually called by the whites a Tuscarora Indian. And
in Bertie County.
Yeah, he had come from there over the year and had established himself when the nation, you know, was scattered.
Yeah.
So when he sounded out his name, there's nobody else in Robeson County anywhere that had the mannerisms and the speech of the people at Prospect. They, even today, if you talk to a lot of folks and ask them what their name is, they'll immediately say, Lockelier. And that was being it all over again. I can see his name on the papers now, the way it sounded it out, and the way the semi-literate people spelled it on the war rolls. So that, to me, I think, you know, is one of the best links to community, to a specific area, Long Swamp. You know where that Long Swamp graveyard is, Willie?
I'm thinking of it.
Go past Preston Chapel, go straight across, and it's up on the left on the edge of that big swamp up there, before you get to Allen McGirt's. Mm-hmm. And so, then, when you look at all the other Lockleyers, all of them, you know, from the same families related, coming from John and Elizabeth Samuel Locklear, that's where the Preston bunch comes from. And Samuel had a three sons that served on the side of the British. They were loyalists with Fannin's brigade. Mm-hmm. And they show up in a Loyalist in the Southern Campaign, a book called Loyalist in the Southern Campaign. And it was these three boys, they said, you know, this story that Sam had, they called him Big Sam, had three sons that were hanged. And it was Jacob, Joseph, and Robert, because they served on the side of the British. And there was a lot of animosity, you know, after that. And so many of them were killed, their houses burned and everything. So those are direct links to Tuscarora. And when you talk to West White, he goes in circles. You know, he's like a beagle hunting deer when the deer is already gone. But he'll halfway agree with you, but he says, I don't know about that.
So coming on down from Bennett and Samuel, those are the connections that Mary Norman talks about. Mm-hmm. Tell us, after that time period where she was writing, where does the evidence for the Tuscarora ancestry come in?
Well, in my particular family, my father talked about his great-grandmother, Peggy Locklear, who was Tuscarora. She was stayed on a piece of land up there that the Moors have now. Harbor can carry you around and show you where her house was. And she chewed red pepper for tobacco. That was from her old tribal heritage. And then there was a woman, one of Isom Locklear's daughters, Feeney, she was married to a man named Jackson Bullitt. Now, to show you the strength of these women, this old clan mother thing coming forward in history, she made him change his name from Jackson Bullard to Jackson Locklear. He was Bullard, but she made him change his name to Locklear. He'll show up in the census records as Jackson Locklear after 1850.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you spell Feeney? What's her name?
P-H-E-N-I-E.
And say that's your, on your father's
my
side?
My daddy's great-grandmother.
Uh-huh.
And let's see, the people in Harpers Ferry, that were half or more Indian, you got pictures of them, Dal Seedy, mm-hmm. and her sister-in-law Lovety, and her children, their children, they come from Prospect. Martha Locklear was Dal Seedy's mother, the Prospect, and Dal Seedy's grandmother was, I can't think of the woman's name right now, but I will in a minute. But for Dal Seedy to be in half or more Indian, her mother would have had to have been whole blood and her father. And so that for that blood to have stayed whole all the way to 1936 and not be half or less, and her children were half or more too, so they would have had to have come from whole blood stock. And this other lady over there, she's not, her picture's not in there, she died in 1909. My mother's great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother, Betsy Locklear, her name was Elizabeth Locklear. She was a daughter of John Brooks and Peggy Locklear. So Peggy Locklear would have had to have been whole blood, because Betsy is, she looks whole blood in a picture that I've got. I should have brought one, I didn't, wasn't thinking. But John was allegedly half-blood Indian that served in the Revolution. And he sired this child, who Elizabeth, Betsy, who was whole blood. She looked whole blood.
Mm-hmm.
So if he'd have been anything like near whole white, he wouldn't have had a child that looked like that.
Mr. Cecil, what about your family?
Well, my family, we should go back to my grandfather, which goes back to, we call him Hector Brooks, and O'Quinn was a son of Hector. That's where my family and my grandmother tie in at.
John Brooks. Now, Hector, John Hector, his name was John Hector. His daddy was Roland Brooks. Mm-hmm. And Roland Brooks' daddy was John, this same Revolutionary War John. John was the father of Roland and Loveday, that my great-great-grandfather Jack Brooks came off of, this woman Harriet Graham, and this woman Betsy Locklear. They were all half-brothers and sisters from this John.
Okay.
That's one of the earlier ties of my bloodline that I know of, and I'm sure there's more, but I think that's the what in 36. And my grandfather on my grandfather's side, who is in this quorum too, which was S.V. Emanuel. Mm-hmm. He was a young man. I think he was about 20 some years old, to 30, 20 or 30.
Mr. Sylvester, was a little bit older than that.
Yeah, older than that. And
he was born in 1870s, I believe.
And he knew, now my grandmother didn't talk about her history as Tuscarora, mm-hmm. but my grandfather, when he was approximately 80 years old, told me, your people are Tuscarora. Well, I kind of doubted him until really didn't know. I went all through the military. I didn't know who my people were until he and I sit down and talk. And then when he told me what he told me, then I started doing the curiosity building me, and I started doing the family genealogy and research, and discovered that my family on my grandmother's side tied all the way back into Mr. Elisha, which he spoke of earlier. Mm-hmm. Later, and so I started doing a little more digging, and like research, I might call it. We call it digging, but research, and begin to verify that our people are Tuscarora. And I have a saying that I say now: the majority of the people in the county and surrounding county are Tuscarora. They just don't know it yet.
That are Indian, The majority of them that are Indian,
right?
LRDA has had a habit, and Ruth Woods made a statement one time that being Indian was a state of mind. Now that, you're discounting any kind of blood ties there. What she's saying by that, if you lived in the Indian community and thought you were Indian, or lived as Indian, then you were Indian, which is really a farce because you're not. And you take some of the black folks around Fairmont and Roland and St. Paul's and Red Springs that have claimed to be Indian all these years. If you went up to them now and claimed that they told them that they wasn't Indian, Willie, they'd cut your throat, wouldn't they? Wouldn't they?
Most likely.
Because you see, they've claimed it so long and they thought they'd been accepted. You see, when I was a small kid, if you had nappy hair, in any kind of features that look like black, you were black. People wouldn't accept you as Indian. And even over here in the schools, not just at the college, but at the elementary school and the high school, they had a committee. If you wanted to go to these schools, you had to get that committee to approve you. When the Smilings came up here around 1900, 1890, 1900 from Marion County, South Carolina, Preacher Thomas Sweat's daddy, Frank and Mag, came with him. The only reason Frank was accepted is his boy Tommy was a preacher. Tommy came into the community and he was accepted as a minister, and therefore his people, you know, sort of were absorbed into the Indian community without the Smilings because of the fact that he was a minister in the Indian churches. So Pernell Sweat and all of them came with the Smilings from Marion County.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk a little bit more about that in terms of, like when you said people in the old days wouldn't accept you as Indian if you didn't look Indian.
Well,
where did the Lumbees, so-called, go wrong?
When the Smilings came up here, they had four school systems. You had the black, you had the Indian, you had the white, and you had the Smiling. Remember Shoe Hill School of Young on 501? That was a Smiling school. That was a Smiling high school. And what, 1960?
What was the population of them? Were there a lot of them?
Well, when you go over to Evans Crossing, you go up to the fire station, and go up to that road. What's the name of that church down that road?
Mount Hebron.
Mount Hebron. Past Mount Hebron all the way to Seven Bridges. 87 over in there. That whole corner was what they called a Smiling and Smiling. Epps community. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people, Gibbses and Eppses and Smilings, that have come in since then. And these people were really dark. They were dark with coarse, bad hair. And they were black and white. In fact, there was a slave owner in Marion County around 1790, a white man whose last name was Smiling. And I don't know, he had upwards of 100 slaves or something. And you know, when slaves were freed, they took the names of their owners, a lot of them. And so my theory on that is that these folks came from that area, because if you back up past 1865 or 70, 1870, going backwards in genealogy, you don't find a lot of these names on your census records. And they're usually listed in slave schedules on census records. They had what they call slave schedules, and a lot of them were listed on slave schedules. So when they came into this area, they were held on the rim of the community, you know. They were not. And every once in a while, here and there, you would have a Locklear or an Oxendine, you know, have an illegitimate child out of wedlock for a black or somebody. And the Wilkinses had it, the, you know, the Hunts, the different ones. And then in those list of pictures there's only one person in that whole list in the Brooks settlement that was black. If you look through there, you find David Locklear. John David loved his son David, married a woman named Kate. Kate was kin to the Bray Boys and Locklears, but what happened with her blood, some of them went on the turpentine thing down into Georgia and had black children and came back. See, that's where Miss Kate come from. And old man Hardy Oxendine, you know, the Oxendines, when you go up to 1166 Cabinet Shop Road, turn left, and there's people that live on the right down that road, Britt Oxendine, Hardy, and all of them. They had an uncle named Floyd Oxendine, that went down to Georgia, and he married a black woman. Some of his kids come up in here in, I guess, 1950s, 60s, and Uncle Floyd came over to the house to show Daddy his wife. No, his daughter. And he asked my daddy, he said, "You see my daughter?" Pointed at, you know, his daughter. "How do you like her?" Daddy said, "Oh, she's all right, Uncle Floyd. She's all right." Well, she was black. She's a black woman. And my great-grandfather, Aaron Brooks, had a sister named Henrietta. In 1869, she married a black man named Calvin Best, and they ran her away. So those kids came back about 1900 looking for their family at my uncle, great-grandfather Aaron Brooks's house over there. And they told them they didn't want nothing to do with them, so they ran them off. For 100 years, this community was closed. Yeah, heard of a closed community?
The Brooks settlement was closed. Mm-hmm.
It was closed like a casket. And they intermarried first cousins, double first cousins. Intermarried, they had a lot of speech impediments. They had a lot of mental defects, that kind of thing. But their blood stayed strong. They kept their Indian features and that kind of thing. But it was such a high high mortality rate, such a high death rate, killing one another. On the weekends, they would go out and get drunk, go to drinking. First thing to do is cut somebody's throat. Could be their brother, could be their own cousin. Time. Be your, killing your own people.
Yeah.
Kind of like the people on the reservations, you know. Mm-hmm. But if a stranger came walking through the community up at Brewer Station and came through that place, they'd watch them until they left at the other end. In the 1920s, they stopped the Trailways buses from running through there. They made them go up through Red Banks. They'd stop them on the road and take the people out of the bus and beat them. They left some of them dead, and Uncle John Brooks is pastor there at Brooks Landing. All kinds of wild things. But things like that, some of it, as far as preserving blood, it was a plus. But as far as reputation, we were a trash pile. And I've had many people, you know, well, my God, how did you come out of that place, you know, get an education? How did you come out and do this? Or how did you come out and do that? Because it was not the character of our community. Our community were laborers, you know, they were farmers, hardworking laborers, that kind of thing. Wasn't much into education. But my mother's mother, she was assistant to her sister, Emma Dees, who taught over at Shiloh Indian School in Scotland County, over near what they call Oak Grove Church. There was an Indian school over there they called Shiloh Indian School. And she taught over there. And so my grandmother, which was her sister, sort of saw the importance. And two or three, my mother had about a sixth, seventh grade education, but she had a photostatic memory. She could tell you what the weather was like 40 years ago when her oldest sister's children were born. And that's, you know, that's something strange. I never run into that before. Very sharp. I beat all I was sawing sheep. I learned a lot. I think I learned more about my people as far as genealogy, as far as kinship ties, things like that, from her than anybody else. And two, laying around the far listening to them old people talk, my grandmother's sisters and brothers, you know, they'd sit up sometimes to 12 o'clock at night,
yeah,
just sit and talk. They had no TVs, so they would sit in front of the fireplace and boil coffee, no lard, kettle, you know, and talk.
Eat peanuts.
Talk about family. And they talked about our people going to the mountains. You remember when the trailer tears, you heard about the trailer tears, the roundup? Mm-hmm. Somebody came through here. I reckon, well, we had a Creek Indian that didn't marry into our family, sired an illegitimate child. And that was my great-great-grandfather, Jack Brooks, who was the grandson of John. And people came through there talking about the government giving away money, you know, and land and mules for Indians that would go west. So a bunch of them went up to the mountains, and Stanley told Connie Brayboy that he didn't believe I could prove this. But I proved it to my satisfaction. That our people went to the mountains, and I was thinking about Tuscarora migrations to the north. I really at the time wasn't thinking about Cherokee removal. And so what they had done, they'd gone up to the area around Cherokee, Burke County up in there, you know, where the Indians were being held in camps and corrals and things. And they went up to see what the government was. Was it true that they were giving away money and that kind of stuff? So when they got up there, they put them in one of these corrals on the ground, you know, these big pens, holding pens. And there was a child born up there who was, they called him Big Joe Locklear. He was born in 1835. So in the 1850 census, when the people gave in their information, they showed this child, they called him Josiah, who was born in Burke County, North Carolina in 1835. So they had gone up there and found out that they were treating them like dogs, you know, they were freezing to death and suffering out there on the ground. And before the Cherokee moved out in 1838, my family, Rhoda and James Locklear, they called him Cricket, and their family, they sneaked off and come back home to the swamps. And in 1850, they were living back here and hadn't gone west. Now, there was a Nathaniel Dial and two or three other families on the Dawes Road out in Oklahoma that really had gone out there, had made the trip. Even with all the death and everything, they still were able to make it. And this Nathaniel Dial, same name as Nathaniel over here on this bunch, you know, here at the Cozy Corner, on 710.
Mm-hmm. That little restaurant's called Cozy.
There's a bunch of Dials over there that this Nathaniel Dial was kin to. And he shows up on the Dawes Road out in Oklahoma, and he's got 8 or 10 young'uns. And there's a Nathaniel Dial over here. I don't know if it was his son or what. They had some of the same names.
Mm-hmm. So some of them came back
Well,
some of their descendants.
Maybe. I think what had happened, there were some that come and some that went. Mm-hmm. There's some Joneses on some of those applications that said their parents were born in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
On those 1936 applications. Mm-hmm. So they had to have been some that either went out there from here in the early 1800s and saw how bad it was and they came back.
So, and it's happened not only then, it happened when the Turpentine movement was.
Yeah.
Well, my grandfather was in that, and they saying they thought it was going to really prosper out there, and some of them did.
You see,
but they moved back here, and in fact, one of the Emanuels lived there. I think what was his name, Edward, or something like that, and it became to be well prospered there, mm-hmm. and came back here. Mm-hmm.
But you see, Turpentine.
You're referring to Mr. E.J. Emanuel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Turpentine to this community. Then was what sheetrock is today. You build and trades. Turpentine was about the only cash job you could actually find. And it was still very popular. And we were running out of longleaf pine forest in this area. You know, they called North Carolina the Rip Van Winkle State. It was sleeping, there wasn't nothing going on, no industry, nothing but farming, sharecropping, that kind of thing. So if people got a chance to go off and make some cash, they took off. And there's Locklear scattered from here through Georgia, Alabama. You can look on your internet and pull them up in Texas. You can pull them up in Arizona. And this woman, Heather Locklear, she's from that bunch in Georgia that Bill Locklear is kin to. Mm-hmm. And they left here in the late 1700s. Either here in Marlboro County, South Carolina, which was actually the same community.
And then the other, in the next migration of Tuscarora people, you may, if you can help me out a little bit, was in what, about 1722?
Well, you see, when the war happened, 1711, 12, and 13, mm-hmm. you see, you had a lot of your people scatter. And family groups, small groups, that kind of thing. And they had fought the Catawba through. They had gone back and forth through here for hundreds of years fighting Catawba. Mm-hmm. The Seneca would run down the crest of the Alleghenies, Appalachian Mountains, 1,000 miles just to kill one Catawba. Mm-hmm. At one time, the Catawba had been up north around the Great Lakes and had been one of the greatest enemies of all of them. They all respected the Catawba as being a great enemy. Said it would come down Appalachians, the Seneca, go by Catawba and kill one and two and whatever, and going around by Tuscarora, across the swamps here. They knew this area like the back of their hand, and stop off there and then go back up north. That went on for hundreds of years, and see, the Tuscarora, by knowing this place so well, that it wasn't claimed by any one nation that was strong enough to keep the whole area, it was a safe place. That the whites couldn't get to them. They could be isolated in the swamps. And so they started sort of magnetizing families, different families from Tuscarora, started magnetizing in this area, and a few over in Kahuri and Sampson County, the Manuals and different ones. And then you wound up here in Robeson County with the bigger group. And the biggest of that group turned out to be the Locklears up on Long Swamp.
Right.
And they had the statute, they had the size. They had the size of the Tuscarora, which were not really tall people. They were sort of slender people. They were 5'5", 5'6", something like that. Most of the Indians were not really big people. And wherever an Indian family was, another Indian family would come in, and if they felt safe, more would come. Until you had something blooming out that really looked like a big Indian community. And then when the whites came through telling the stories about the money, land, and the mules that the Cherokee were being offered, you see, the Indians here went up to check it out. And it just grew from there, just kept blossoming out.
Now, in the 20th century, when after the 1930s, when the bid for recognition essentially failed, What do you think changed or shifted about that way of knowing ourselves? As whether you call it Tuscarora or Indian and having the blood identification, what changed to result in Ruth Woods's comment of Indian being a state of mind?
Well, a lot of you white Indians, a lot of you storefront, you know, you educated people, they wanted to be in charge and run the show. And that's where, you know, they couldn't control the longhouse in the Brooks settlement, okay? That was a given. They couldn't get hold of it. Mm-hmm. Rather than let them control it, they shut it down in 1951, and it was gone.
In fact, I'd say this. Keever asked me about that, and he said, and when Full Lowry, Hugh Full Lowry was known as supposed to have been, and he was at that time, according to the eyesight of Indian people, was an educated man. And there's a quote that's in the courthouse, which I've seen, and he asked me, you want to see this quote about what Fuller said about Indian people in Robeson County? And the whole idea was of the whites was for their land was to get their mindset away from being Indian. Once you could ever do that, you could get them away from really where they belong and what was good for them. And that was the fathering of the Lumbee Bill. And what was quoted by Fuller Lowry is, if Indian ever come back to Robeson County, my people will take up and leave Robeson County. In fact, in these documents, you'll find one of his brothers, right?
His boy
showing up marrying a Tuscarora woman. Have you seen that?
And
he himself claiming to be Tuscarora descent. Mm-hmm. And was right, because it came through the James Lowry and William Lowry crowd.
So if you could ever get these people looking towards something else other than who they are, such as a new name, and remember now, it wasn't popular to be Indian anywhere in the whole country. So he gets these people looking at this bill, which began in 52, 53, somewhere along, that's when it started really taking hold. And he figured if he could ever get Earl of Carlisle to side with him, to get this bill passed and get their sights away from who they really are. And and you asked a question earlier, you know, that was the beginning of the Lumbee thing.
Well, let's play the devil's advocate in a minute.
Okay.
Let's say that you got all these people that don't know who they are. Let's say that you got all these people that are not sure who they are.
Okay.
Some of them want to be Indian if they can get recognized and get the money. They'll go along with it, but they can't prove that they're Tuscarora, and they can't prove that they're Catawba, they can't prove that they're nothing else. Since they live here beside the Lumber River, and since all these other people along these rivers were called the Wateree, the Catawba, the Sugaree, different names like that, it would be so easy to say Lumbee. And this would give us an umbrella that all of us could get under. And we'll make all these foolish people over here get under too, because they're claiming to be traditional Indian. And we don't want that going on, because that'll be too radical. So Lumbee was good for politics. It was a good political name, and it was neutral. It wouldn't upset nobody. It wouldn't upset the Cherokee.
And the whites didn't want things to be upset anyway, because if they could keep these this thing about their true identity and keep civil authority, that they would tend their farms, and sharecropping was big business for the whites, and so therefore if they could keep them appeased and not cause a disturbance, they would make money while they kept them down. And so give them something that they could be satisfied with, and wouldn't have this disturbance, and it wouldn't cause the economy. The economy was already bad, but it wouldn't cause the economy to be even worse than what it was.
And then during the 70s came along, the Tuscarora movement really took off. It started as the ECIO. Then it broke off into the splinter groups, you know, the little groups of Tuscarora.
Mm-hmm. Go back and tell us what ECIO is and,
Eastern
and
Carolina,
how that was founded.
Eastern Carolina Indian Organization. It was a group of people who were of Tuscarora descent. And really started out, when it started out, as I said, for a couple of the 2-3 years, every meeting we had, there was 400 and 500 people. I mean, the place would be swamped.
And this was in the late 1960s?
71, 2 and 3. 70
and 71.
Okay.
Yeah, early 70s.
And then bands started breaking up. You had the different groups, and then when the AIM people came in, you know, to help with recognition, to help to push the awareness, the houses started being burned and the double voting broke and all the demonstrations and sit-ins, and then it became too radical for the leadership. The white Indians wouldn't have nothing to do with it because they didn't want to be associated with Tuscarora because they considered Tuscarora radicals and trash. Even though the Tuscarora had the history, they had the best history, but Tuscarora was mainly led by a lot of people who were unlearned, academically unaware, and things like that. And so, you know, college-educated people are not going to be led by folks who were not up to their par. And that was a big thing. And then, like I said a while ago, about the old longhouse over there, they couldn't control that because the people wouldn't let them have it, wouldn't let them have the control. And they started low-rating Pikey Brooks and Well and running them down. And when it stopped in 1951, then the Lumbee thing started, and it was sort of a neutral thing that they could all fit under. And even in the 70s and 80s, you still had this rich Tuscarora history, but because it was associated with radical people, the white collar Indian didn't want nothing to do with it. Even though it would have,
like they made reference to them old Indians.
It would have got them
foolish ending.
It would have got them recognized earlier with a traditional history, mm-hmm. and yet they went all the way to Chiral looking for history, and the migrations never were from the west to the east. The migrations were always from the east to the west. Yeah. Every migration you find among Indian people, it's been from the east to the west.
Mm-hmm. In fact, we find, Tuscarora showing up in South Carolina, Goins and whatever. They're showing up all over down there.
But see, a lot of that was slaves, Indian slaves, mm-hmm. That had been sold around Charleston and places like that. Mm-hmm. And there was 100, I believe, sold in Charleston at one time, and a lot of them went up to Boston. They were sold in Boston. Places like Bahama, Cuba, to work in tobacco, and sugar cane and stuff like that.
Let me go back just a little bit to the, which a lot of people don't know, is the migration from North Carolina to New York,
mm-hmm. okay,
which you well know.
Tell us about that.
8 years ago, 9 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago now, the Tuscarora was here, and a delegation of about 15 people went to Niagara Falls, to New York.
Lewiston,
New York. And what is it, somehow some folks had, well, in fact, we had three or four people came from New York to visit over on the river up at Drowning Creek, they call it, or over with Leon, and we were there, and we were still associating each other. They had always been told that Tuscarora had sold out their rights from North Carolina, and North Carolina was paying for them to stay out of here and whatever, so they wanted to know, and they were called, some of those folks were called the Anderson. In fact, we got very acquainted with them. And they couldn't believe that they didn't know where they came from. So they wanted to know for sure. So they came and visited here, and visited people. And first Tuscarora that I knew that came from New York to come to visit us here, we call him Mad Barry Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And I sit under his, listen to hear him talking. to tell him, to listen to how he told the migration, how his family migrated up the rivers and all the way to New York to survival because of the hardships here. Now, that's the only group that I know of that migrated north instead of going from east to west. But it's a good story. And if you go there to visit and you have a little powwow like we did, and you'd think it was in Robeson County because you've seen all these people, the drums are beating and what have you. But I wanted, local people need to know, and they needed to know, where their bloodline is. And their bloodline is North Carolina. And so they don't know that unless this history is told, you know, and passed down to generations, people don't know where they come from. In fact, Mr. Lawrence Maynard always say, come see people who don't know who they are. That was his saying. But all the time that we met in the early 70s, and finding out, trying to find out where we were coming from, and curiosity, and that's how I got involved, because I could not see anything to where my people were Lumbee people. Could not. In fact, I may have been one of a few people who were told by my grandparent that you're not Lumbee, you're Tuscarora. Mm-hmm. But being taught Lumbee, could not believe what I am. But then after validating it, like Mr. Lodge, of course, Mr. Lodge's family did. And my dad would take me up to the longhouse and to the little powwows, you know, as early as 9 years old. Mm-hmm. So my people wasn't totally bought out by the people, the so-called name under the umbrella of Lumbee.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people weren't. My dad went up there, you know, when he was, well, let's see, he would have been probably about that same age, but he's a little older than you are, so. But his dad was interested in it, you know, they were from Red Banks, and that's what, they never fully bought into it either. But I think that was a sort of a common, somewhat common experience for a lot of people whose voices haven't been heard from, you know, in the history. And actually, that takes, since you mentioned the Longhouse, I was wondering if y'all could explain what the Longhouse is, both prior to Kiever coming along, you know, back in the, was it in the 20s or the 30s when? 1928. Talk about what it was and how it was founded.
There was
where
a group of Mohawk came down here and during the late 20s, and they helped lay out the longhouse and set up the ceremonies, and one man's they called him Chief Snow, and along with my granny's brother Pikey Brooks and Will Brooks, and they started having ceremonies every Saturday. It was an all day thing on Saturday, and it was actually set up, I don't know which band of Mohawk, I've never been able to find out. And they, see, back then they wasn't good at record keeping, so they didn't do a lot of paperwork. They were not learned when it came to the pen, so there wasn't a whole lot said about it on paper. But it was Mohawk that came down and set it up, and 1928 is when it was built. It was, in fact, I got a picture of it. 1928, it run to 1951, 51 or 52.
Mm-hmm. And where was that?
Actually, you know where Harpers Ferry Road forks into 74? Mm-hmm. Just before you get to the fork, there's a big cinder block house on the left, right in there in the forks. If you turned on this side of that house and that through that little drive and went across 74, directly over to where the man's got the little small engine shop, Lester Locklear. His shop sits in the front. Yeah, his shop sits in the front door of where the longhouse stood.
Mm-hmm. And that's the last time I ever remember. First time I ever remember going to the longhouse, and I can remember so well. My dad taking me there and the powwow all dancing all the way around the house, and I mean, and it stuck within my mind. I must have been probably about 8 years old. Or 7 or 8 years old at that time, and that just stuck with me ever since. Mm-hmm. The Mohawks wanted to keep the tradition, since the trade-in was with the northern people, we call it, the Tuscaroras, and up to places like Highway 74 and all the way up into that four-way. It's kind of hard for sometimes people to kind of vision that people traded one another that so much then. And then it really excited me to go to that power. I could just about vision see them now. Mr. Lashley remember it too, and I'm not that old, but just keep some of those traditions alive. And
it was a couple of hundred feet long, about 100 feet wide. It had a tin roof built out of logs. And that's what all the long houses up north are built out of, cedar logs.
What is the connection in these big farmers like the McNairs and Pate Supply, and as far as the land was concerned?
Well, what happened, you see, the Indians were squatting on the land without title. And these folks came in and were given grants of land, 200 acres here, 200 acres there, for a few shillings. In the colonial days, they operated on British currency. They operated on British pounds.
Mm-hmm. Hold just a second, let me flip it over.
Yeah, we'll go ahead and flip it over.
In the colonial days, the whites would come in. McNair is a Scottish name. Came down with the Scots, you know, from the Cape Fear area. And they would be given grants of land for a few dollars, British currency, whatever that amounted to. And as I said, the Indians, 1750s, they didn't have any title to land. Probably one of the earliest Indians I know of that had title to land would have probably been John Locklear or John Oxendine, somebody like that. They're about the first ones to show up on land grant records.
Well, that would have been about 1770.
1750s. 1750? And then 50s, 60s, and then Dudley Locklear and Major and John, you know, and all them coming in here from Edgecombe County area. See, Indians were pretty much on the same level with the whites until the Revolution. They fought with them in the Revolution. They sort of bided them, you know, and allowed them pretty much citizen rights. John was given bounty land, and he sold it to somebody, and they would pick up a few hundred acres here and there. And then 1835, when the slave revolt started, mm-hmm. Nat Turner Rebellion in Eastern Virginia. Indians, any kind of non-white was disenfranchised. They lost the right to vote. They lost the right to keep and bear arms and all that, you know. And so if an Indian left Harper's Ferry community and wanted to go over to Prospect or to Pembroke, or what was now Pembroke, someplace like that, another community, they had to get some white to sign them a paper saying it was all right to travel, because they would be illegally out of their area, you know, and so it was kind of like a permission pass. This went on until Lowry came along, the Lowry Wars, and they lost their right to have guns, and the whites were able to mamak over them, you know, and do them anyway. They had their guns confiscated. And people with the whites would take their, if they had land at that time, whites could move in on them and take it and swear they stole something from them, you know.
Like Pates and
condemned their land. Well, the Livermores, now the Livermores that ran this Pates thing over here, they were carpetbaggers that came in here in 1865 from Ohio. The Livermores and this O.S. Hayes that managed the Red Bank farm, he was in the state legislature as a state senator in 1873, O.S. Hayes was, and he was a carpetbagger. You know, the Republicans, after the war between the states. But this was the situation until Henry Barry Lowry brought a lot of attention to it. And the Indians, you know, some of them started standing up for themselves and trying to survive. But see, a white couldn't witness against another. I mean, an Indian couldn't witness against a white because if they done them wrong, a black couldn't witness against a white. And after the Reconstruction troops left, it went back to the old status quo. You were free, but you didn't have any power to enforce your freedom. You could vote, but you couldn't afford to pay the poll tax that allowed you to vote. And so if you got into any kind of trouble with the government, the local authorities, anybody like that, and you didn't have some kind of white person to speak for you, you were lost. Mm-hmm. So the McNairs could come in, you know, and pick up as somebody next to them, you know, if they wanted their land, they could offer them what they thought was a fair price. If they didn't want to take it, they found somewhere forcing them out.
Was Johnson Cotton Company, all those, were they connected?
Who?
Johnson Cotton Company. Down to Lumberton.
Well, now, the Biggses, the Pates, the Livermores, the McNairs, all those, they had these company stores. And they would bring them in, you know, bring in these poor people who had land, and they would sell them fertilizer or a mule to make life easier for them. And I understand that their interest rates were so exorbitant that they were able, within a year's time, to confiscate anything the poor man owned. Many times his wagon, his mules, and just leave him sitting with nothing. Maybe a laborer owned their farm. They might have 10 or 15 young'uns. And they were born into that old sharecropper mentality, and they died there. It wasn't until the 1950s when a little bit of industry like Converse and Hasty, this furniture place of it, Alma and a couple other places, when the war started. Actually, I think World War II, I think World War II was the savior to most Indians, because a lot of them went into the Army and found out that they could operate as a first-class citizen. And they came out of the Army with GI Bill rights to go to college and that kind of thing. So that broke a lot.
Do you have any?
That broke a lot of the sharecropper things. That broke a lot of them away. In fact, the Army helped me get off the farm and, you know, as a laborer.
So did me.
And then when I come back, I was able to go to college, you know, and get away from that mess on the farm.
Like my
picking cotton, cropping the back and stuff like that.
I said, there got to be something better than this. And so I went to New York, hitchhiked to New York, 18 years old. I mean, can I kind of imagine me going from North Carolina hitchhiking to Delaware and then catching a bus from there to New York City at 18 years old in 1961.
But see, you could get away from here, and where you're working here for $3 a day on the farm, you could go places like that, you know, and get minimum wage or get a better job and actually make some good money and come back home, and people thought you had, they thought you had bought the world nearly.
And then left there when the Cuban crisis ended, and didn't go, actually volunteered, enlisted into the Army, because I certainly didn't want to go back to the tobacco field. You know, that's all I ever knew was cotton field, tobacco field, corn field.
Those land that hadn't been touched in years, like the desert, over where your church is at, that whole area when there was called a desert.
Let me tell you about that. Before I tell you about that, though, just about land. Pardon me?
Johnson Cotton Company, one of those guys.
McNair's.
Went in there and cleared the land. But they say they didn't buy it, they leased the land, because the land actually belongs to Indian people.
The federal government had a thing over there.
Yeah, you go up there now, I can go up there and show you the federal land survey marker of that land today.
Right.
So McNair's got a 99-year lease. And that was in the documents that came out of the BIA. Mm-hmm. What also came out of the BIA was, right here, Red Bank. strike it to win.
Right, I know the connector.
And I, Cheever had to die, and here's what, and I can quote and tell you exactly how many acres was in there on the land grant. 9,399 acres.
And that was all the way back to Colonial now.
Yeah.
Is there a plain document?
Yes, there is a document. I read the document to that. Cheever, when we met on Friday night, I read the document to Cheever and the group, 9,399 acres. That's a land grant.
Yeah.
Yeah, later. And you know, that's when I sit in on in 1983 and was arrested on Red Banks, that's what we protested about. The land belonged to Indian people, but yet it was whisked away by conniving associations such as the Red Banks Mutual Association.
See, Willie Harris and them sold that land about 2-3 times.
Yeah.
But the Mineers and all of them, they sort of controlled the whole land profit and everything else, because they had means of selling. You could sell your tobacco to them.
Right.
You could sell your cotton to them. Yeah. So mm-hmm. they were in control. Didn't they also try to intervene in getting some of the money, if you got any, with the denying? You remember the little document we read about that?
The 22?
They owned the church. White people that settled in this area.
Yeah, there was a Mount Moriah Church down. No, gosh, I don't remember exactly.
Mount Moriah Church is on. When you go to 1166, go past Evans Crossing, mm-hmm. go all the way down to Lochness Cabinet Shop, go down to the cabinet shop and turn right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mount Moriah is right mm-hmm. over there somewhere.
Yeah.
And what happened? You had the Sinclair Farm, the McNair Farm, the Evans Farm, all these farms were owned by big white slaveholding families. So when those families died out, the McNairs bought their rights to this land. And so when the government came in here, the rural, the thing from the FHA resettlement, they bought up the old Baker Farm, the Baker Plantation, which is down Baker Road. It used to be an old, just like a dirt trail. They bought that, they bought the Red Banks Farms, and two or three, they bought about 5 or 6 pieces of land. I got a map of it somewhere. And what they done, this Beaufort Lumber Company come in here then. I think the Beaufort Lumber Company bought the timber rights from the government. And they built little spur railroads up into these places and cut every stick of timber they could find. They just killed it, clear cut it. And then when the government started selling it to Indians, you know, after this FHA thing, 1936, BIA and FHA were in here like this. BIA was working over here looking for Indians under the Wheeler Howard Act. Mm-hmm. And FHA was over here buying up surplus land to resell to Indians. See, a lot of Indians had the impression that the government was buying that land to give to recognize Indians.
Right.
But what they done, and there's a petition that a lot of our people over here signed about this Baker Place and 2 or 3 other things, federal court petition, and they petitioned the government for this land to resell to them. And then the government's selling it to them for what, $2-3 an acre? I forgot what it was, but anyway, that petition deals with that. But the FHA were not buying land to set up a reservation. Our folks thought they were buying it to set up a reservation.
Right, they sure did. And
You had two different animals here working at one time. You had the BIA over here looking for Indians. And they would go to different places and set up and, you know, and have mm-hmm. blood tests. And the blood tests were legitimate in what it was doing. See, the blood test was done by the Army Medical Corps, and people said, you can't tell whether a person's Indian by testing their blood. What they were doing, they were looking at the chromosomes, genetics, looking for parenthood. You know, like they do now to prove if a child, somebody's, if I'm your child or whatever, yeah. And so what they did with the blood test was to try to prove illegitimacy or legitimacy.
Yeah.
If you got 10 young'uns in your family, And they blood tested all of them and checked the chromosomes. Two of them could be called illegitimate because they didn't have the father and the mother's correct blood that the other four kids had. Okay? So that would disqualify them from being a half or more Indian, even though they were looked as much Indian as my great-granny Dal City. But if they were illegitimate, see, they couldn't prove their ancestry because they were illegitimate. This woman had this child for somebody, some other man, either before or even after she was married to the man she's living with. Now, her three children over here that had the correct chromosomes, they could be enrolled as half or more Indian, but that over there that was illegitimate couldn't. That's where the blood tests come in at. Then you looked at the facial features, you looked at the hair, you looked at the, you know, stature and all these other things.
And
if all of that worked, if the blood was right, that was right, and then you had your genealogy complete, you were enrolled as half or more Indian. But if one of those things was out of place, it disqualified you. And there was a whole lot more Indians than 22, but the reason ours was in such good shape is, like I said, you see, we had the closed community. Prospect was a closed community. They'd kill you if you went in there trying to take up residence and they didn't want you.
And this
Harper's Ferry would do the same thing.
Communities are still close, and I'm going to give you an example of that. Have you ever thought about why Indian people have such a problem with being diabetic? Because of genetics, close genetics. And that's why...
Not marrying out.
Right. And that's why the sugar, diabetics among Indian people is the worst.
Can I use your phone just a minute?
Yeah. Willie, why don't you just put that on pause while he's on the phone? That's kind of...
Going back to... Brother Elisha alluded, you know, to these very facts that during World War II, that our Native American people served in the military and participated in those campaigns, and they were just like I was. By moving to New York in the early 60s and getting away from the farm at 18 years of age, I seen something I'd never seen before, that people were, and which all people like, and that is they had jobs, they were able to work and pay for what they get, and that was a, it was more than a privilege.
And people respected them as same class people.
Yeah. And so I seen that as a way out from the sharecropping farm. And after that, I went into the military, and I seen it, how I could rank and rank as high as anyone else. But now I didn't see the prejudice that the World War I people seen. And so when I got out of the military, I certainly didn't want to come back to the farm. I wanted to go back to New York. But by that time in 1965, I seen that, you know, from the people were getting jobs and the economy was a little better than them $3 a day from the farm. So it gave me a whole new perspective of future, is to being able to work for what I get and pay for it and to have a family. And I began to discover then, hey, this is better than being on a reservation, and actually it's better than federal recognition, because I had discovered so many of these people living on these reservations and the problems they have.
And I heard white people refer to Indians working on their farms as turd head, you know, and stuff like that. But when I went in the military, I drew propay, Willie, as a weapons specialist. That was a little above a lot of those folks, and they couldn't handle that. They didn't know how to deal with this Indian coming in here, you know, being that good with their weapons. And I tell you that, you know, that done something to my ego. Really?
Mine too. I
got rid of the inferiority complex.
Sergeant E5 at 22 years of age, and I seen this. It was an economic boost for me, and being able to get into the airborne, I joined the airborne because I knew I could get $55 more per jump in every month. It was economic for me. And I took advantage of that. And in fact, when I got out, I was able to buy land and pay for it. So a lot of military men were able to do that. And for me, you know, Patrick's
wife had taken
not be on reservation and see the things that
must have been about 10 minutes ago
suffered from not having the education and alcoholic and those types of things was a plus for me to see that.
Okay.
And I still say that economically we've got the most highly educated lawyers and doctors of any tribal people across the country, and it's simply because we have not been forced into isolation or to reservation.
Well, people, you know, when you've been suppressed and you actually get the chance to succeed, you try harder. Folks that have the silver spoon, they really don't have much get up and go about them because they've already arrived. They don't really have any place much to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's then talk then about the late 1960s and 1970s for a while when y'all came back from the military and had that experience. You know, you've got this background of starting to discover who you are, what the real history is of the people here, and talk about some about the development. Sort of, it sounds to me from the little bit that I know that what Kiever did was revitalize the longhouse that had been shut down in 51. Is that sort of accurate to say? And well, he was a leader in that, or talk about those early, you know, maybe early is the wrong word, but that time period when Kiever began to get more active and sort
well,
of.
Well, I think you have to equate Kiever with the other groups that were in existence along with him.
Okay.
We actually had four or five splinter groups.
Mm-hmm.
You had the Vermilion Loyola.
Hatteras Tuscarora.
Hatteras Tuscarora.
Mm-hmm.
You had
UL
up at Maxton.
Johnny Creek.
UL actually tried to do it, but UL didn't have much of a go at it. But Leon sort of came in and absorbed what UL was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had Kiva. And since then, you've had the Tuscarora tribe. You've had the folks over at Burn Swamp.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And even had a little bunch coming up out of Shannon. I don't know who they were. But.
Okay. Well, what made those groups begin to get together in the first place?
Well, I think Indian awareness. Anytime you got a bunch of Indians that are proud to be Indian, and they see something that looks like it's going somewhere, and it's for the people. Lumbee LRDA has turned a lot of people off because they have a select group of people that run the place. They have a select group of leadership. And they sort of shut it up with those.
Mm-hmm.
And since the Lumbee tribe took over from LRDA, people still see LRDA in the Lumbee council, in the tribe. They see the same people, they see the same attitude, you know, that kind of thing. Tuscarora is shut out. And it's still, if you're Tuscarora, you're trash. But if you go over and denounce your rights as Tuscarora and sign up as Lumbee, you see you move up on their pecking order.
That seems to sound more prestigious, is what it does. But Kiever offered, you know, with the mother wit that he had and what the only know-how that he had, he offered the same thing to the remaining people like myself who were Tuscarora but hadn't really moved out and advocated that fact. He offered the same thing he actually offered a hope here to your heritage, whereas the same thing happened in the early 50s that offered the Lumbee some hope there. Because you got to remember, all through these years, it wasn't popular to be Indian anywhere. It wasn't popular because we had our own, that's why we had our own schools and had our own churches and places like that. It wasn't popular. Nobody wanted us.
And
we were outcasts.
Some of us
did y'all ever have an event of any kind that you stood up for certain things and certain, like to take over the culture center? And
yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's where I got my start at. You see, I got, when I was arrested on Red Banks, see, I knew what was in those documents pertaining to the 9,399 acres of land. Mm-hmm. We took the only action that we knew without, and didn't have the money to pay big lawyers, we took the only action we knew how to do is to lock ourselves inside and force the authorities to come to arrest us, forced us, the local authorities, to recognize us. It was a type of recognition. We couldn't get through any other way. At the same time, there was what was his name that came down from Maine?
Tom Terrain.
Tom Terrain, who was trying to help the Maynard versus Morton case, and try to get somewhere with that, and that lawsuit was in process, and it was filed in the case was filed in 1973, right?
Yeah, I believe you were.
Maynard versus Morton. Lawsuit was filed, Maynard sued for his rights as an Indian, not a Lumbee. But the bad mistake was it wasn't filed as a class action lawsuit. So that spilled over into our desires to see something change among Tuscarora people. The school system had failed. We lost it. The Tuscaroras were accused of being the radicals who were burning up everything, but it wasn't so. And so we didn't, and then the case about the school system, when Braxton had refused to allow his children, Braxton Chagos refused to allow his children to be forced out of their own school, and district-wise. So we seen this thing as this land.
Hey, Miss Lisa.
Here in Red Banks. Is a way of initiating our concern. So we protested, and that was set in, and we cut their own locks off and got inside and put our own locks on it to force the county and the state to come to our rescue. We were no different than those people in 1913 who wanted better for our children.
Y'all mind if I run around there and check and see where my grandson is?
No, go ahead.
So it was my way of saying we want better than what we have.
Now, about what year was that, Mr. Cecil?
That was 1983.
Yeah. So, just for the purposes of the tape recorder, tell us, what the issue was about. You just sort of said it, but just back up and say it one more time. Why y'all went in there to do the sit-in?
Well, land rights was a major issue. We knew that this land should have been set aside for Indian people. Here it was, had been purchased three times and then stolen away again by people with education, such as the Red Banks Mutual Association, had whisked it away again. Mm-hmm. And economics had not taken place on it. In fact, there was a school. Hospitals were supposed to be, from what we understood, was to be built on that 9,000 acres of land. It was for farming. It was for economic purposes and education purposes. So we seen that not being materialized, and by meeting every Friday night at ECIO building, East Carolina Tuscarora, these issues become to be a concern of many of us. But and I don't mind telling you, I didn't have a high school education and a 1 year of electronics, and I was the highest educated person there among all these people. And they looked up to me because I could read the documents that they had, and I could understand them. So little did I know when I was arrested that there was a justice group, law justice group in Maine, who was monitoring our arrest.
Okay, so tell us why you were arrested.
We were arrested for protesting on the North Carolina said state land. We were trespassing, which we knew we wasn't, because the land that we were arrested on was the last 60 acres that was not carved out and sold off to landowners.
Right, after the 1930s.
And it's still today under the Interior Department hands. And we knew that from documents that we had in our file.
So we seen that as a way to draw attention to ourselves for injustice in the court system, injustice for land being taken away, and for schools that should have been built for Indian people. Okay, we seen this as a to the system of North Carolina and society around us denying us of those same privileges that all men would like to have, mm-hmm. no matter what color they are. So we seen that as a way of protesting it to get some things going. In fact, that was the initiation of the Tuscarora Tribe of North Carolina, because we sit in on that, we got attention to that, and then I went on to be a court monitor for 3 years as a volunteer court monitor. I was recruited to do that in the courts, and today, let me tell you what came out of that today. By my sitting there and being recruited as a court monitor to monitor the judges and the lawyers in the court system, 22%, and I do have these documents I was going through in the day to try to help get some of this so I could share that with you. All of those documents for 8 to 10 years I have in my file. We went along with Herbert Moore and those people to develop what we call a rural justice program. You remember?
Yes.
I was just board of director for that, along with Herbert Moore. And so let me tell you some of the things that come out of that, which a lot of people don't know, and I'm not to pat myself on the back. The first Native American judge came out of that. Dexter Brooks. Bush double voting, merger of the school system. Even though in the 70s we wanted our own school, but you know, just look at another almost 13 years or so, or 15 years later, this thing came along and to break double voting and that we merged the school system. I supported school merger because, as you know, we were not getting equal rights in the education system because we were getting old books and we were getting secondhand education, which was good. So we seen these things as for Indian people as a future for our own people. So I protested on that. So the judicial system today now has how many lawyers now, and look at the judges that we have. But we never had any Native American lawyers who were willing to go to bat for us as far as 9,000 acres of land set aside on the land grant for Indian people. We never had no local lawyers to go to bat when Chapel Hill had at that time produced 8 attorneys.
Indian attorneys.
Indian attorneys to go. And I'll quote a quote from Byron DeKale, who was a law professor at Chapel Hill, and he said, "Cecil, when we graduated 8 Native American attorneys from here, we would have thought and hoped that they would go back to Robeson County to take up the rights of Indian people, but he says apparently that's not the case."
See, Robeson County is such a strong legal community in the white settlement that, remember Willie Swan, Horace Locklear, and different ones? They stepped sideways defending the wrong case. They had evidence planted in their offices. They had their phones tapped. They had things happen to cause them to be disbarred because they defended the wrong cases. If you have a certain type case now in the Indian community and you actually need neutral legal help, you have to go outside to get it, because local Indian lawyers are afraid to pick up certain things. Arnold Locklear right now wouldn't touch a case dealing with Indian recognition to save your life.
Willie Swan was one of those willing to do that. In fact, he was one who represented us when I sued the federal government and signed off on the lawsuit for $20 million and held the state of North Carolina for discrimination against Indian people in 1983. Mm-hmm. And the legal system disbarred him when he said, then after he says, I've always wanted one of these Indian cases. I never forget the day he said, he come out of the courtroom and he says, I've always wanted one of these Indian cases. Never seen the man before in my life. But he knew we were in court for trespass on the land. And so we hired him, and that's when we sued Joe Freeman Brent, sued the United States government for what, $26 million. And that's when we had, and holding the state of North Carolina liable for discrimination against Indian people, and that was such as the Red Bank situation.
And see, at that time, you didn't have any Indians in a position like you do now with right. sheriffs and county commissioners and registered deeds, offices like that. Registered deeds used to be the most powerful office in Robeson County.
And it was out of that Red Bank situation that people began to organize and come out of this apathy. Hey, we can make a difference. And the court system, when we had 22% of Indian people going through the court system, 14 to 15% whites going through the court system and getting convicted, and 19% of the blacks getting convicted, but yet, on that note, 22% of the Native American people were being convicted when I had a district attorney who had a 6% dismissal rate nationwide, when he ended up in the world's Guinness Book of Records for convicting the most people.
Putting the most on death row.
Such as Velma Barfield and those things. And here was this man holding a Guinness Book of World Records. We call for injustice. So we broke that. We dealt with the court systems. And then along came like that, and so people had to have a reason to be active, to be involved. And then the line came like that. You remember in 88, the Jimmy Earl Cummings case came along. That even fueled that.
Now describe that. What happened to him?
Jimmy Earl Cummings was on.
Penny-handed drug dealer,
stopped by the sheriff's son, Kevin
Stone,
and searched his vehicle, and he had just, so Kevin Stone suspected he had a few grams, and he swings a bucket at Kevin, and Kevin sees that opportunity to defend himself and kills Jimmy Earl Cummings over the swing of a 5-gallon bucket. And so some of the people said, this is injustice. So Herbert Locklear came from all the way from Baltimore, Maryland, and I was in the first meeting to be part of that. Well, we already had the court monitoring going on. We were making changes, making suggestions to the higher courts of North Carolina that we need a Native American judge. A school merger was taking place at that time, and we had a few blacks who rallied with us to support our cause. And it didn't just become to be an Indian cause out of that Red Bank's arrest over there. It became to be an injustice cause across the county. A few blacks and a few whites, and we were able to convince people in the judicial system, but there's something wrong here with this system. And if you look around today, a lot of people don't know why we've got people in, especially Indian people, in places now to where we used to see white, such as Joanne Locklear. And I highly supported these types, Joanne Locklear and Dexter Brooks and Gary Locklear and Jeffrey Wynn, and all of these Indian attorneys now. Now, if you want something done with traffic violations, things like that, which we were getting convicted of, people going to jail. And let me show another thing with what was happening to the Indian people. By our high incarceration, 22%, this is what drove the white society saying this is the way of getting these people, Indian people, out of the way. Getting active prison time, that causes family breakup and our families to end up on welfare. A man sitting in jail when he should be out of jail, and his wife and his children at home are struggling trying to make it, but yet here's the head of the household in jail. So these are the type of things that bring, and not only does it bring depression and oppression, It brings gainful employed people off the gainful employed list by that.
And two, you know, you're coming off the sharecropping farms and your self-esteem is low.
Mine.
When you go to jail charged with something and you look at a man like Joe Freeman Britt with his cigar in his mouth in the courtroom and he's standing in your face, blowing his breath in your face, and you're scared to death of him because everything there is white. You know you're going to jail. Even though you're innocent, you're going to jail because they're going to work out a plea bargain with you. Say, now listen, you can accept the lesser of the two. You can go ahead and plead guilty to a lesser charge. We'll give you 10 years. Might be circumstantial evidence. I've known people that spent their life in prison on circumstantial evidence that wasn't even there. But because they were so threatened when they went into that court system, you see, they were cowed by Britt and whoever else was in charge. They decided to go ahead, well, if they're going to send me to prison for 30 years and I can get off for 10, my God, I might as well accept the lesser one because I'm not getting another court. They ain't getting another trial.
After that arrest on Red Bank, strike at the wind, whatever you want to call it, I was cowed during the process over a period of 12 months. I was calendared 9 times to be tried. And guess what Joe Freeman Britt would do? The way he got into the world Guinness Book of Records, he would calendar us, say, your case is going to be heard today. We had a lawyer hired all the way from Sheely Michael, Michael Sheely out of Charlotte, you know, a long way. He'd come down to represent our case, and Joe Freeman Britt would say, we're not going to hear this case. But when he would say that, guess what he would do? Calendar you, and he made me go to court 9 times, and guess what? At 5 minutes to 5, we're not going to have this case today. Well, you know, I took off my job. I'm self-employed. Had I not been self-employed, I would have never been able to survive. I'd have had 10 years in prison because I was charged with 2 felonies. They dropped one of them. I ended up plea bargain with the state of North Carolina for trespass. Had I known what I know now, I never did that. I was willing to take my chances on 10 years for the rights and justice of people. And that's the type of thing that I had to go through with. And I was arrested, and any people at that time, well, they're gonna send me to jail anyway, so they wouldn't end up in court. When their calendar time would come, they'd never show up for court. Well, that gave the system the opportunity to go back and arrest them, bring them back to jail, put them in jail, make them pay another bond. This was the type of thing that was going on and causing all of this high incarceration of Indian people at the time.
It was a manipulation of the system.
Well, no,
and the other thing is, there were so many people who had such an empathy, you'll never break this system, that nothing can be done. And this is the whole idea of outsiders coming in and helping us. And I did this for 3 years and nobody knew what I was doing. It's sitting in the court, monitoring the comments of judges, like the Judge Richardson making comments about you are so ugly or things like that. You don't hear these things in the court.
Interrogatory
remarks to an open court.
Yeah, that's a violation of civil rights.
Absolutely. And settling cases when the defendant wasn't even there. Mm-hmm. I've seen that happen in the courts of Robeson County.
And you know, the legal system operates on a revolving door basis anyway. Mm-hmm. That's what keeps your lawyers keeps their money coming in.
And the state paying lawyers $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year just to represent cases. Mm-hmm. And it keeps
self-perpetuating.
Yeah, the word I was looking for a while ago is very lucrative business.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of money made. That was a lot of money.
And we monitored all lawyers who had cases. I did that, like I say, for 3 years. We documented the facts. We were able to go to Judge Exum at that time, who was over the court system, and And we had, had we just been Indian people doing this, we would have never got anywhere. But what happened was you had some sympathetic whites who had moved here from places like Virginia and Maine, and retired lawyers and judges who I worked with when Julian Pierce was killed. They were here at that time.
National Council of Churches.
National Council of Churches.
AIM. Justice Department.
Rural Justice Program out of Tarboro, North Carolina. These people who were set up to do these type of things.
What was the man's name from New York?
William Consular.
Consular.
In fact, I was the man who called William Consular to represent Eddie Hatcher. I said, Mr. Consular, what would it take for you to represent Eddie Hatcher? He says, only did he allow me to stay on the case. Not a dime. Only if you'll just sign a document, allow me to stay on the case.
Yeah, he was known for that.
I was picked up the phone right down the street down there and called him and asked him, would he take Eddie Hatcher's case? Which, you know, Eddie Hatcher later on. Had Eddie Hatcher would have took my advice, he would have never got a day of time.
But he you see, when they threw the court out, a case out in federal court in Fayetteville,
right.
We had bought them a ticket. We had got the money together to buy them a ticket, and they wouldn't leave.
And I begged him, don't plea bargain with the state of North Carolina. And he plea bargained.
Well, he changed his stand, too.
See, Eddie come back here and made fun of Robeson County,
right.
And thought he was going to hide out in Pembroke.
Right.
And threw barbs at him down there, and they got mad. Mm-hmm. So they, when they found out he was here, they started this thing. If he'd have left like we told him to,
when we
walked out of that courtroom in Fayetteville, the judge dismissed the case, mm-hmm. declared it what, innocent, not guilty, both of them, and we'd raise money to buy him a ticket to get him out of Robinson.
His head swelled up.
Yeah.
Big because man. Then he started talking about contacting the communists.
And like, Eddie didn't have a bit more Indian in him hardly than Stanley Nick over here. Yet he had got off not guilty, and he come back to puff himself up.
The churches was supporting him.
Yeah, but what Eddie did, and the Robinsonian, whether we like it or not, I don't like the tactical crime, but whether we like it or not, it finished off.
It had a good place.
It wasn't right. The court system in Robinson County.
And he hit it at the right time.
But some of the things that come about as a result of it was good.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, it wasn't right, but in itself it wasn't right, but the attention that it got, worldwide attention, national attention, I mean, that helped our folks a bunch.
And it first started about identifying drugs, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.